Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for standing by. My name is Kelly, and I will be your operator today. Welcome to the Sherritt International Corporation's first quarter 2019 results release conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the prepared remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. I would like to remind everyone that this conference call is being recorded today, Friday, April 26, 2019, at 9:00 A.M. Eastern Time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Joe Racanelli, Director of Investor Relations and Communications. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. We released our results last night after market close, and our materials, including MD&A, financial statements, and press release, are on our website as well as on SEDAR. Before we begin, I'd like to remind everyone that we will be making use of a presentation that is available from our website at sherritt.com. As well, we will be making forward-looking statements, and risks associated with these statements are detailed in our presentation. With me are David Pathe, our CEO, Steve Wood, our Chief Operating Officer, and Andrew Snowden, our Chief Financial Officer, who will be reviewing our results in more detail imminently. I'd like to turn over the call now to David.
Okay. Thanks, Joe, and good morning. Quite a lot going on at the moment, both internally and externally, so a number of things that we want to tell you a bit about this morning before we get to your questions. As ever, Steve will talk a bit about operational things, and Andrew will highlight a few things for the financials before I come back and give updates on a few of the bigger things that are going on. But first, I just want to touch on a couple highlights and a bit on what we're seeing in markets. Operationally, it was a very good quarter for us. The efforts that we've been making on operational excellence and getting greater and more reliable production out of Moa continue to pay off. We had a good consistent quarter in production and a significant improvement on Q1 of last year when production was affected by heavy rains and rail service disruptions in Western Canada. The refinery in the first quarter this year hit the milestone that we talked about before of 3 billion pounds of nickel production over its 65 years in existence. The world has changed immeasurably in the 65 years that operation has been running, and for that operation to continue to be a world-class nickel and cobalt facility, I think, is a real testament to the agility and capability of the people on the ground there running them, making that happen on a day-to-day basis. And I want to acknowledge all of them for that significant and important milestone. We've talked often in the past about volatility in commodity prices and nickel and cobalt markets. This past quarter has been a particularly wild ride. Dramatic movements in the cobalt price have had a pretty significant effect on our net direct cash cost and our earnings in the quarter, and Andrew will shed a bit more light on that as he comes up in a few minutes. Looking at cobalt markets now, I'm on to slide six in our presentation here. You can really see what happened over the course of the quarter. We came out of the last year in a declining nickel and cobalt price environment. The second half of last year was marked by pretty significant declines in pricing for both compared to where we were a year ago. What we saw in the first quarter is some divergence there. Nickel really bottomed out and showed some signs of recovery. Thus far in the quarter, it's kind of been able to hold on to those gains reasonably well, but with a little volatility. But the move in cobalt prices was quite dramatic. You can see there in our graph that it was down 28% on the LME reference price. The Fast Markets quote, which is what we actually use for pricing a lot more of our nickel and our nickel sales, was actually more dramatic. It started off the quarter at about $27 a pound and finished the quarter around $14, so nearly a 50% decline in the quarter on commodity price for cobalt. And that had quite an impact on our net direct cash cost, including the resulting in some adjustments to pricing from the previous quarter that were scheduled to actually be finally settled in Q1. And Andrew will give you a bit of sense of that as well. In terms of what's driving that, you know, we did see some easing of, although we don't seem to have a final agreement yet between China and the U.S., some easing over the course of the quarter in terms of the level of concern about that. We continue to see actually pretty good fundamentals in the nickel market. Reasonable tightness led to some recovery in the price. Cobalt, on the other hand, was pretty abundant in the quarter, and the downward pressure continued as cobalt consumers destocked inventory rather than buying, and others looking to buy cobalt deferred in the falling price environment. Coming into Q2, we do seem to have seen that finally bottom out in what was a relatively free-falling cobalt price in middle of the quarter. It now seems to have leveled out and recovered a little bit, and we're hoping that we'll see that cobalt kind of find its feet and gain some strength over the rest of the year here. In terms of underlying fundamentals, longer term, we think the prospects of nickel continue to look very strong. Slide 8 shows you the trend in global inventories over the last year and a half or so. The inventory decline that started in late 16 and 17 accelerated and picked up pace in 2018 and has continued into 2019. Inventories are down by more than half since the 1st of January, and that's on the back of pretty strong stainless demand and continuing growth in battery nickel demand. Demand for batteries is expected to grow by about a third this year, and stainless steel by 3-5% as well. There's still no real meaningful supply side response to nickel, particularly for Class 1 nickel, under the lack of investment in the industry really for the past 10 years since the financial crisis. So we continue to be confident in the long-term fundamentals of the nickel market, particularly Class 1 nickel that we produce. Slide 9 shows you what we've seen really just quarter to date through April here, and so that highlights the bounce that we seem to have seen in the cobalt price. We are seeing our discounts and premiums to that cobalt price finally start to narrow a bit closer to the reference price compared to what we were seeing in the quarter, so we are getting a bit of added benefit from that as well. So we're feeling a little bit better about the cobalt market, but obviously it has a way to go from where people were predicting it would be this time last year. Nickel markets have been relatively flat this quarter, come off a little bit this week, but the underlying story there, I think, continues to be strong as well. There are a few other external events that I want to give you a bit more context on, but before I come back and do that, Steve's going to tell you a little bit about a few of the highlights from our operations this quarter.
Okay, thanks, Dave, and good morning, everybody. As I normally do, I will comment on our health and safety improvement plans before getting into the details of our production numbers. We continue to see improvements as a result of our work on visible felt leadership and fatal risk prevention. And more recently, we've had increasing efforts on process safety management and are expecting to further improve our safety results. Moving on to slide 11, I'll talk a bit about the Metals Enterprise production highlights. On a 50% basis, MOA produced 4,397 tons of nickel and 426 tons of cobalt in the quarter. Combined, this total represents our best production result for a first quarter period ever. This record total was achieved as a result of several operational excellence initiatives that we've launched over the past 18 months, and I'll elaborate on those initiatives in a couple of minutes. When we compare our production results from the first quarter of this year to that of last year, it's important to remember that our results last year were impacted by reduced availability of mixed sulfides due to the heaviest rainfall we had at MOA in more than 20 years, as well as some transportation delays to the refinery in Fort Saskatchewan as a result of some issues with the railway service provider. I'd also like to point out that consistent with previous years, we're slated to have our planned maintenance shutdown in June of this year. The planned maintenance shutdown is slated to last approximately 10 days, and as is to be expected, it will have a bearing on our production results for the quarter, but is absolutely necessary to continue to produce at a reliable and high rate that we have been experiencing. NDCC in the quarter was $4.53 a pound, and that's up $2.06 from last year in the same quarter. The increase was due to a number of factors and was largely driven by the 70% decline in realized cobalt prices. The sharp decline of cobalt prices in the quarter was also resulted in adjustments to some of the provisionally priced contracts from the previous quarter of 2018, and the effect of these adjustments was an increase on NDCC of approximately 40 cents a pound. By way of context, we generated about $1.15 of cobalt credits per pound in Q1 of 2019, and that's down from $4.27 of cobalt credits for last year at the same quarter, despite selling 135 more tons of cobalt this year in that quarter. And as a reminder, just for those who are new to the concept, the revenue from the sale of the finished cobalt is treated as a credit and used to offset unit costs involved in the production of the finished nickel. Turning to slide 12 now, I'd like to talk a little bit about the operational excellence initiatives that have been underway and the results we're starting to see from those efforts we put in over the last couple of years. During the time, we have launched a number of initiatives aimed at improving efficiencies, reducing costs, and increasing output. And as evidenced by our record first quarter production total, our commitment to operational excellence is working. Our initiative aimed at improving mining equipment availability, for example, was particularly effective. Starting in Q2 of 2018, we acquired a number of new mining trucks and related equipment, and that included 24 of the trucks additionally in Q1 of this year. The new equipment is more reliable, less expensive to operate, and helping to grow our production numbers down there at Moa. Related to improving the mining equipment availability, of course, is our initiative to increase ore stockpiles, and this was undertaken to mitigate the effects of the rainy season and any other issues that we might experience during the year. Currently, we have about 3 months' worth of stockpiles built. We recently completed another initiative, we commissioned the slurry prep plant dump pocket, and that helps us to improve our ore screening and reduce waste haulage, and we expect to see increasing benefits of this dump pocket in the coming quarters. Now turning to oil and gas on slide 13, we produced 1,776 barrels of oil equivalent per day on a net working basis in the quarter. This total marked a decline of approximately 55% from last year when we produced 3,916 barrels per day. The decrease was due to a number of factors, the most notable of them being the decline in profit oil percentage from 45% to 6% at PEU Marie as a result of the extension of the contract there. The decrease was also due to the natural decline of the maturing fields that we're producing from. And as is to be expected, the decrease in the number of barrels produced had a negative impact on our unit costs. The unit costs in Cuba for the quarter were $21.19 a barrel, and that's up from the $20.83 for the same quarter of last year. Our unit costs were also negatively affected by the weakening of the Canadian dollar relative to the U.S. dollar. On slide 14, I'll talk a little bit about the power highlights. We produced 173 gigawatts of electricity in the quarter, and that's down 14% from last year in the same quarter when we produced 202. The decline is largely due to the reduced availability of the natural gas that we use to produce the electricity, as well as the rescheduling of some maintenance activities on our steam turbine at Veradero that carried over from the previous year. And as with oiling the gas division, our unit costs were negatively impacted by the depreciation of the Canadian dollar. That concludes my comments on the operational results, and so now I'll turn it over to our CFO, Andrew Snowden.
Okay, thanks, Steve. So as you heard from David, volatile cobalt prices did have a significant impact on our financial results in the first quarter. This significant decline in cobalt prices resulted in approximately a $20 million decline in our share of MOA's cobalt revenue. In this slide, you'll see the significant decrease in the cobalt reference price quarter over quarter. The cobalt reference price represents the market price that we sell our cobalt at, which is data, based on data provided by Fast Markets. And this decline is based on the factors which David reviewed earlier in the presentation. You'll see, though, from a cobalt realized price perspective, the realized price quarter over quarter fell by a larger decline than that 52%. And looking at the slide here, you'll see that that fell 70% quarter over quarter. And that's because in addition to the lower market price or the lower reference price, we also had fairly significant provisional pricing adjustments in the quarter. And that's based on sales which were made in the fourth quarter of last year, where the pricing wasn't finalized until Q1 this year. And we had approximately 200 tons of cobalt contracts where that provisional pricing existed at the end of 2018. And as Steve referenced earlier, that as well as impacting revenue, obviously impacted our NDCC as well by approximately 40 cents in the quarter. With the rise in the cobalt price in April, though, we should see both of these trends start to reverse through the course of Q2. Turning now to slide 17, I just wanted to review our adjusted EBITDA Q1 of this year versus Q4 of last year. I should point out, though, that both of these totals exclude Mbatovi, as Mbatovi is no longer considered an operating segment, and that's due to our defaulting shareholder status following our decision not to fund the Mbatovi cash call in March. As you can see from this slide, the most significant impact to EBITDA Q4 to Q1 of this year is really this significant decline in the cobalt price and also the provisional price adjustments that we refer to. So that's clearly the key driver behind our weaker EBITDA in Q1. On slide 18, I just want to make a few comments on our liquidity. We ended the quarter with $177 million of consolidated cash and cash equivalents, which compares to $207 million at the end of December. The main driver behind that decrease in cash through the course of Q1 relates to a negative change in working capital of about $27 million during the quarter, and that's due to primarily timing differences on our fertilizer collections, but also the lower-than-expected collections on our Cuban energy receivables. Generally speaking, working capital changes, though, do represent timing differences. And to put that in perspective, our working capital change in the fourth quarter of last year was a positive impact of $30 million. I do also want to just remind everyone that of the $177 million consolidated cash we have at the end of the year, that does include our one-third consolidation of Enagas's cash balance. And due to the delayed payments from Enagas to Sherritt, this third share of Enagas's cash balance that's included in the $177 million is approximately $70 million at the end of Q1. So the final slide I have some comments on here is on slide 19, where I just wanted to review a couple of the key implications described in our March press release as a result of Sherritt becoming a non-funding Mbatovi shareholder. Now, just as a reminder, at the beginning of March, we received a cash call from Mbatovi of $5.4 million US, which represented our 12% share of a $45 million cash call that was requested. Consistent with our strategy of preserving liquidity, we did elect not to fund that cash call. And there were a number of implications as a result of that, and I'll just review a couple of the key ones here. I mean, firstly, despite not funding our cash call, our current ownership interest in Mbatovi has not changed, but our economic interest is now the new funding provided by Sumitomo and Coras does sit above our distributions in the Mbatovi waterfall and will be repaid to Sumitomo and Coras in priority to amounts paid to Sherritt. Sumitomo and Coras also do have the option to fund on our behalf. They haven't made that decision yet, but if they did, they could also elect to receive an equivalent amount of our highest-ranking debt, which would result in a further dilution of our economic interest. One of the points I wanted to just highlight is the impact this has on our Mbatovi partner loan. So this is the approximately $150 million you'll see on our balance sheet. There's been no change to the 2023 maturity on these loans, but the lenders do potentially have recourse to Sherritt, which is limited to our interest in Mbatovi. And due to that potential to call on our interest, that has resulted in a reclassification of the loans from non-current occurrence, and so you'll see that reported on our balance sheet at the end of March. I do want to highlight, though, that that has no impact on our cash requirements on that liability. And as I mentioned, the maturity for that liability remains in 2023, and we don't expect there'll be any cash payments until 2023 or beyond. Finally, just on disclosure, just to recap a comment I made earlier, is that we have concluded that Embattevi is no longer an operating segment, and you will see that impact some of our disclosure in our MD&A. So we have reduced the level of disclosure on Embattevi, particularly some of the financial metrics, and so that will be something that will, I'm sure, be highlighted as you review our MD&A. So that concludes my comments, and I'll pass the call back to Dave.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. There are two or three other matters here that I want to just give you a bit of color and context on before we come to take your questions. The first is the Helms-Burton Act and changes in application of the Helms-Burton Act. This has attracted some interest and attention in recent weeks in headlines, and we have had phone calls from a number of you, so I did want to provide a little context on that. The Helms-Burton Act, you'll recall, and those who have followed us a long time will be familiar with it, actually dates back to 1996. It's the Helms-Burton Act. It was an act of the U.S. Government against to take various actions against Cuba. It's the Helms-Burton Act Title IV that the State Department continues to deny entry to the U.S. For much of the senior management team here at Sherritt. And it's now this Title III that you'll have heard of that they're now contemplating actually allowing to come into force. Title III provides a right for parties that had assets expropriated by the Cuban government to take action against anybody who's subsequently participating in those assets, and we are potentially doing that in our activities in Cuba. This was quite controversial when it was enacted in 1996 and attracted a pretty strong opposition from the Canadian government, the European Union, and others that led to a provision that entitled the U.S. president to defer implementation of the Helms-Burton Act for periods of up to 6 months. And what for the last 23 years, presidents of both political stripes in the U.S. have exercised their discretion to defer implementation for successive six-month periods. What we've seen happen over the course of the first quarter this year is a couple of shorter deferrals, and now most recently an announcement that come the 2nd of May, the U.S. government is going to allow Title III to actually come into effect. What that means for us, we think, is not terribly significant, but it will attract some attention. Those of you that have followed us a long time will know that, frankly, our business has been organized for this eventuality since the Helms-Burton Act came into effect in 1996. We have no businesses in the U.S., we have no assets in the U.S., and that has been a very conscious decision in the way Sherritt was reorganized in the onset of the Helms-Burton Act in 1996, and we have maintained that. Subsequent to that, the reaction of Canadian and other governments has been to object to the extraterritorial nature and the way Helms-Burton and Title III is applied. The Canadian government and other governments around the world, and the EU and Mexico and other, have enacted blocking statutes to make enforcement of Helms-Burton judgments illegal in Canada, and also give a rise of a right of an equal and opposite right of action for anybody that does commence a Helms-Burton action. Where we could take action against them in Canada for whatever amount that they were able to be awarded by a U.S. court. So in the upshot of this, we don't expect this to have any material impact on our operations. From a business perspective, it's business as usual for us in Cuba, and we continue in all the activities that we have been. But you may well see this continue to create some noise and headlines in the newspapers in the week ahead. In slide 22, we just highlight the statement that the joint statement that the Canadian and EU put out in the wake of the announcement of the implementation of Title III. The Canadian government has been very strong on this. We've been working very closely and continue to work very closely with Global Affairs on this matter. They've been very supportive, and we're appreciative of that relationship, and we continue to work with them on how this will get managed going forward as implementation takes place next week. Cuban receivables, disappointing quarter, frankly, from a collections perspective. We collected about $5.5 million Foreign currency continues to be a difficult issue in Cuba, made somewhat more difficult by U.S. actions towards Cuba at the moment. We have had a bit better start to the second quarter. We've collected about $5.7 million, I think, in April thus far. And we continue to work with our Cuban partners on getting access to liquidity. We did talk in February on our year-end call that we have an agreement in principle on some arrangements that would give us access, more direct line access to hard currency. Foreign currency plans in Cuba require quite a number of hoops to be jumped through, but we do feel that we're making progress on that. The intention is that gets done, and we're hoping to see that potentially as soon as next month. We would capture a portion of foreign currency that our MOA joint venture uses each month to purchase local currency to pay local suppliers and local expenses in the MOA area. We're hoping we'll be able to capture about $2.5 million of that a month from Energas and have that available to distribute to us against the Energas receivables. We're also looking at an arrangement that would see us capture a share of the Cuban share of MOA dividends above $16 million. So obviously how much we can recover on that will be a function of commodity prices over the rest of the year. But that is the general regime that we are working towards getting finalized with our Cuban partners. Lastly, I want to provide another quick update for you on where we are on Block 10. Picking up on where we left off when we discussed this in February, we did carry on through the first quarter in getting our plans and getting equipment on site for this new drilling while casing technology that we now have access to. A lot of work has been done understanding what the geology that led to the instability that we are finding in the hole. And if you flip over from 24 to 25, there's a bit of a schematic where you get through into the down below the green zones in the upper reservoir through what's labeled there as the Constancia and the lower Vega Alta. That's where we were encountering hole instability that led us to abandon a couple of attempts to get casing behind that, those sections of the geology behind casing before progressing into the lower, darker green reservoirs, which are our target on this well. We were able to resume drilling on the 1st of April with new mud chemistry and new tools and pressure management drilling and this drag along casing ready to go when it's time to start inserting casing. We have drilled now through the Constancia and through the lower Vega Alta. We are basically on the cusp of that lower reservoir, and once we're confident we're in that lower reservoir, that's when we'll stop and then deploy the drag along casing to try and get that hole sealed off behind casing and then proceed with the last 1,000 meters of the hole through the several zones of the lower reservoir there. Thus far, the drilling has proceeded pretty well according to plan. We seem to have quite a clean and stable hole. The changes in mud chemistry that we've made seem to be having some positive effect on maintaining stability and keeping the hole relatively clean. And in the coming days and weeks here, we'll be getting that hole behind casing and progressing down in the reservoir. And we hope to have some more results for you to share with you on what we're actually finding down in that lower reservoir this coming quarter. So that's where we stand on that. Overall, as you've kind of got a sense of from the conversation and commentary from the three of us today, it is a particularly busy time for us here, both internally and reacting to some pretty volatile external events. But we remain focused on operations and continued solid production. I think we're lined up pretty well in terms of mixed sulfide in the pipeline and inventory ready to keep the pressure on the refinery where we want to see it for good production for the next couple quarters here. And that's where our focus will remain. So with that, operator, we'd be happy to take any questions anyone might have.
At this time, I'd like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. Your first question comes from line of Orest Wowkodaw from Scotiabank. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Good morning, gentlemen. A couple of questions for me. First of all, with respect to the overdue Cuban receivables, Andrew, can you just walk us through exactly where these are sitting and how they're disclosed on your balance sheet?
Sure. And I think the slide, let me just go back to Dave's slide. So slide 23 does provide a bit more detail behind some of the line items for these receivables. So you'll see, I mean, of the total $171 million, $172 that's outstanding, approximately, what's that, $55 million relates to trade receivables, both in oil and gas and power. And so that sits within our receivable line item on the balance sheet. So that's all within trade receivables. As a current liability, correct.
Okay.
Sorry, current receivable.
Yeah.
And then the Enagas CSA amount, which is the larger amount there, of $115 million, that sits within the advances line item, which is advances and loans receivable. And the total amount there, that I think it's in the region of $220 million, that's owed on the Enagas CSA, of which 115 is due and payable today.
Okay. And you mentioned earlier that I believe it's $73 million of your consolidated cash balance is held by Energas. Can you just remind me, does that mean it's stuck in Cuba? Like, is that cash actually available to you to service, you know, your corporate bonds and things like that? Or is that effectively locked in Cuba?
So that cash already sits within the Enagas operation in Cuba. That point is really tied to the overdue receivables, in that if the Cuban government was current with its receivables to Sherritt, then that cash which currently sits within the Enagas entity should be repaid to Sherritt. And if that is repaid, then obviously our overdue receivables, and particularly this Enagas CSA balance, will reduce, and the Enagas cash balance will reduce. And in return for that, obviously Sherritt's cash balance at the top level here in Canada will increase.
Okay. And so are we at the point yet that we're getting concerned with corporate liquidity if that cash is unavailable because of the overdue receivables? I mean, it sounds like you've got really corporate cash then of, call it $100 million.
That's right, Orris. I think right now our cash within Canada is somewhere in the region of $100 to $105 million.
Okay. And then just switching to Amitobi, how come this is not being recognized as a discontinued operation?
I missed that question, Orris.
Just on Amitobi, like, if you're effectively stripping it out now, why is it not considered a discontinued operation from your perspective?
So, from a disclosure perspective, Orris, we're limited to the kind of IFRS accounting rules, and at this point, there's no, to be a discontinued operation or a held for sale asset, we would have to have a plan to sell that business. At this point, we're a defaulting shareholder, although have the ability to buy back into Ambatovi if we chose to. And because of that, the current accounting framework, i.e. equity accounting, will continue.
Okay. And then, I'm assuming you're going to get diluted to zero here, but why is Sherritt staying in this as an operator?
Staying in as operator is part of one of the commitments we made, at least until 2024, in connection with the restructuring that we completed when we went from being a 40% shareholder to a 12% shareholder. That's when we got $1.5 billion in debt off the balance sheet and through that reduction in our equity ownership. But part of the value we still bring to this project from the senior lenders and from our partners' perspective is the technical advice that we still give to the management team down there, and that was one of the few bargaining chips we had in the context of that restructuring, and that was the commitment we made whenever it was we closed that 40 for 12 fix.
Your next question comes from the line of Don DeMarco from National Bank. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First, a couple questions on Ambatovi. So what was it that prompted the change in your disclosures for Ambatovi? I mean, in the past, you've opted to not fund cash calls, and the financial reporting remained unchanged.
Look, I mean, last time around, Don, when we didn't fund the cash calls, we were in negotiations with our shareholders on trying to reduce our equity interest from 40% to 12%, and we're undecided on you know what that would mean in terms of cash into Ambatovi. You know, at this point now, we're a non-funding shareholder into Ambatovi. We don't have any plans to commence funding, and so this defaulting shareholder status that we currently see ourselves in is a more permanent position or a more permanent situation, and really that's reducing the level of disclosure that we require from Ambatovi, and obviously results in the way that changing the way that we see the business and changing our disclosure.
Okay, and on this, maybe if you could provide a little bit more color on why the JV partner loan was classified as current, and is there any conditions, if any conditions, would you be required to actually pay this debt out in 12 months?
So there's, I mean, just to reiterate, Don, there's no requirement for us to pay that in cash until 2023. So that's the maturity date of that liability, yeah. And that remains unchanged. The reason we've reclassified it to current is really an accounting requirement based on the fact that there is a potential for the lenders to call on the limited recourse security, which would be our shares in Ambatovi. And because there is that potential that exists out there, that results in this reclassification to a current liability, which to me doesn't make complete sense because obviously from a cash perspective, there's no cash outflow until 2023 or beyond, but that's the kind of accounting conclusion we had to adopt.
Okay, and so even if you're diluted to zero, the obligation to Sumitomo Corea's would still mature in 2023. You're not going to have it's reported as current, but you don't anticipate under any circumstances that you'd actually have to pay it out sooner than 2023.
Correct.
Okay. Then just shifting over to the Cuban receivables, it wasn't clear to me, what is the timeline that you're hopeful for full repayment of this $172 million? Like, do you think it would come ahead of the 2021 maturities?
John, that's certainly been our objective in the context of our conversations with the Cubans and trying to put some arrangements in place. If we get something in place finalized along the lines of what I was just talking about there, how much we see this year and next year will clearly be a function of the nickel and cobalt price, but seeing that balance come down back into current between now and the Q4 2021 when we face our first debt maturity is what we've told the Cubans is our imperative.
Your next question comes from the line of Greg Barnes from TD Securities. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you. Andrew, I guess a question for you again around this $70 million held at the Antigas level in cash. Is that actual cash in Cuba at Energas?
So I mean, Energas has within Cuba has its own cash balance that's owned by that joint operation, and we consolidate a third of that cash balance, which is the $70 million on our consolidated balance sheet. So it does exist within Energas's bank accounts, but in terms of that being repaid to share it, that is all linked to this overdue receivable matter that we're trying to resolve, and really that the transfer of that cash to share it is dependent on foreign currency availability within Cuba.
That I don't understand. what is preventing it from being transferred to you to offset the receivables? They don't have the cash, or they do have the cash?
It's cash in the bank in the local currency, right?
Right. So the issue is the Cubans' liquidity of foreign cash reserves for us to be able to repatriate that in Canadian or U.S. dollars. So it sits in a Cuban bank, denominated in the local currency, to be fulsome on our receivables disclosure. We don't consider that paid from a receivables perspective until it's available to us in hard currency. So although we have it in the bank in Cuba and it's available to us and we use it to pay local taxes, local expenses and our gas, but we still consider it overdue until it's available to us in a foreign currency that we can repatriate to Canada. And that's where Cuba's national foreign reserves liquidity issue affects us.
I got you. Okay, that's clear. And again, Andrew, on the partner loan, what's preventing Sumitomo and Corus just saying, okay, we'll take your 12% stake in Mbadavi, be done with it, and the partner loan's taken care of?
So, look, from our discussions with Sumitomo and Corus, you know, they have no interest in doing that. I mean, clearly, if either Sumitomo or Corus were to do that, that would increase their own ownership interest in Mbatovi and their own exposure to Mbatovi. And right now, Mbatovi is obviously draining cash rather than providing cash. So, you know, based on our discussions with both of the other Mbatovi shareholders, they provided verbal confirmation that they have no interest in looking at calling that security.
Okay. So no one wants it, basically, at the end of the day.
Just a little further context on that, Greg, and for everyone, you'll also recall that the project financing down there had a three-year deferral on the amortization schedule that actually expires in June. So the focus of our partners right now is on the ongoing conversations with the banks on what a further deferral on the amortization schedule down there might like. That payment right now, there's a $90-odd million principal repayment coming due in June that Mbatovi simply won't have the cash flow to make. And so that's been well recognized by the partners and the lenders for some time. And so there is an ongoing series of conversations around that issue, which is where the partners' focus is at the moment. As that resolves itself in some form, I suspect that in the wake of that, we'll be then looking for a more permanent solution to the rest of the capital structure, again, with respect to our equity ownership and the CFA loans. We've been clear throughout the piece for some period that we don't have the capacity to make further cash payments into the project, and so the mantra of no cash in, no cash out for the foreseeable future that we've been touting for some time in Mbatovi continues to be our priority in this, and then that's the basis of the actions that we've taken.
Okay, that's great. That's very helpful, David. It's clearer now.
Good.
Your next question comes from the line of Tony Robson from Global Mining Research. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you for taking my question. You mentioned destocking of cobalt inventory by consumers. Has it all come to an end? Was the more recent price rally due to that lack of selling pressure, or is we actually seeing the consumers now coming back into the market and buying? The second question would be also on commodity price, nickel. As you pointed out, nickel inventories well down year on year. Looks like the market is in deficit. Any hope on nickel at hitting $6, $7, $8? When do you see that, please? Thank you.
Tony, to your first question, I think we are seeing the beginnings of that. We're seeing a bit more uptick in demand. There's been a little upward pressure on the price this month, and there are people out buying cobalt again now, or at least looking to buy cobalt in a way that they weren't a couple months ago. But I think we're kind of in the early days of that this month, and we'll see whether that kind of trend of reversing itself of what we've seen in cobalt for the last two or three quarters, that reversing trend that's kind of just begun in the last few weeks continues and gains strength, but that is what I think we're seeing the beginnings of now. On nickel, I really wish I knew what to tell you, Tony. We have this kind of, I think, unsustainable over the long term pricing going on right now, where physical markets continue to be reasonably tight, and global inventories continue to come down. Consumption continues to exceed production, with no prospect of meaningful additions to production of Class 1 in the near term, and yet we haven't seen any meaningful response in the price. We believe that the underlying fundamentals of that were particularly on the where there isn't the capacity of a supply side to respond to meaningful increases in demand for Class 1 nickel on a short-term basis, at some point does have to impact the price. When that happens and where that takes it, I have proven to not be any better at predicting that than anybody else. But we do think ultimately to create the incentive prices, it's going to need to create more Class 1 nickel supply. That price is higher than $5.63 or wherever we are this morning. And so we continue to believe that in the longer term, over the medium and long term here, nickel prices for Class 1 nickel need to move higher.
Thank you. Just in the shorter term then, because again, the crystal ball gazing, my call's no better than yours. Are your traders, your marketing guys, seeing any softening in demand? We've obviously seen some weakening in economic stats, say out of the EU and some other parts of the world. Is that coming through as a reduced demand for your nickel, or can you sell every pound you make?
Selling nickel even through the end of last year, when it was really bottoming out, selling nickel wasn't really an issue for us in any great way. Selling cobalt in the first quarter was tough at times, and there was a lot of cobalt around. You know, cobalt, anybody looking to buy cobalt in February and March had quite a number of people calling them up. But the supply and demand dynamics for actual physical metal in the nickel market have been pretty good throughout this period of declining prices that we've already seen since the second quarter last year, and now bounced back a bit, but the underlying physical market's been pretty good.
Okay, thank you. No further question.
Your next question comes from the line of Orest Wowkodaw from Scotiabank. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking the follow-up there. I just wanted to discuss the Cuban receivables one more time. What I'm having a bit of trouble understanding is, given the pressure that Cuba is under, which seems to be increasing from the U.S., what today gives you confidence that the Cubans actually have the ability to start repaying this? And what I'm wondering is it possible we could see the opposite here in terms of these receivables actually continue to increase rather than decrease? Any color on this would be very helpful. Thank you.
Look, obviously it is a big issue for us, Orest, and the economic circumstances that Cuba are in as the U.S. makes their life more difficult continues to put pressure on their foreign currency transaction capability. What helps us is if we can get this these arrangements that we've been talking to them about done for some time, is that there is actually a direct line for us to the hard currency in the form of the hard currency revenue of the MOA joint venture. MOA sells its nickel internationally. Our Cuban receivables issue always arises in our power business, in our oil business, because the customer is various entities of the Cuban state. So we're exposed to Cuban credit in our power business, in our oil business. The MOA joint venture is different in that the customers are all international, and it's hard currency sales, and the revenue for that all flows into the marketing arm of the joint venture in the Bahamas, and then each party takes their share home from there. So we've never had a receivables issue in the MOA joint venture. If we can get these arrangements that we've been talking to the Cubans about, and they are, in my belief, working in good faith to get that done, we would actually be able to capture some of that hard currency directly in the form of revenue that the MOA joint venture currently uses to buy local currency from the central bank to pay local expenses in MOA. It will instead buy that local currency, at least to the tune of $2.5 million a month, roughly, from Energas, and then that Energas balance that we have there can then, that hard currency that goes into Energas can be available for distribution to us. Additionally, if we can get the arrangements finalized where we capture a share of the Cubans' dividends in the MOA joint venture, rather than us taking our 50% share and them taking their 50% share home from the Bahamas when we divide up the pot at the end of the day, we can capture that. That is another source of hard currency that we can then apply and offset against Cuban receivables, where we're not dependent on the local Cuban economy's ability to generate hard currency to repay us.
And your understanding is that there's buy-in from the Cubans on this proposal?
Yes, I mean, that's the agreement in principle that we have in February. And as you can imagine, foreign currency reserves are pretty tightly managed in Cuba at the best of times. And so there are a number of different ministries that need to approve this and ultimately the Council of Ministers. But it has been going through reviews with the with the central bank and the Minister of Economic Planning and the Ministry of Finance, in addition to the Minister of Energy and Mining, and Minister of Foreign Investment, where we negotiated this over the first half of the first quarter. It's my belief, for what it's worth, that they are in good faith trying to get this done, and still intend to see us made whole on that. They understand the significance of the cash to us. They understand the significance of our debt position, and we're an important partner to them. And I still believe they are working in good faith to deal with that in what are undoubtedly pretty difficult circumstances for them right now.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Matt Farwell from Imperial Capital. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. And thank you for that explanation. Can you give us an idea of how long you've been having those discussions with the Cuban government over the receivables proposal?
Oh, I mean, the flippant answer to that is we've been talking to the Cuban government about receivables for 20 years. We've had ebbs and flows to the receivables balance, you know, going back to 2008 when it got well up north of $250 million, and we put an arrangement in place to have weekly amortizing notes from the central bank that ultimately paid out like clockwork and made us whole again. There's been an ebb and flow to the availability of hard currency in Cuba since the revolution, but they have always been able to muddle through, and they've never denied that they owe us money, and they've always ultimately made us whole. The receivables balance that we have now has obviously crept up over the last 18 months or so, and we've had ongoing conversations with them over the course of last year. The more specifically, I think, is where your question's really going, is in terms of on these just kind of receivables arrangement that we're trying to put in place now. That really began and began getting some traction for us kind of in November or December this year. And then in January, and in a series of meetings that I and Andrew Snowden and Elvin Saruk, who runs our oil and power business, were at, that led to the kind of agreement in principle kind of term sheet that they could then start taking around the different houses in Havana to get approval. I got finalized in early February, and we're still working through them to get those final approvals in place. Does that give you a bit of context of what this, if I haven't answered your question?
That's exactly what I was asking for, just a little more background. Thank you. And secondly, I just want to clarify on the Amatovi JV. You are certainly implying that there would be no cross defaults on the rest of your debt regarding that project loan, number one, and I think you can affirm that. And then secondly, does your operating position, does that provide you some leverage on the restructuring of that JV, whereby you might be able to retain an equity stake, on the back end of a pro forma restructuring?
I think we'll see how all that plays out. We are not concerned. We do have, in terms of that right to accelerate on the equity in Ambatovi, they have acknowledged for now that they were not exercised that right, but that will be up for renewal as we get closer to the June deadline for the senior debt, and that'll all become part and parcel of the conversation going on. Where our objective in this has been to not see any more cash come out of our balance sheet, and given our priority of maximizing liquidity and eliminating debt from our balance sheet for the last few years. How this plays out will depend on the partners and the lenders do still see value in us being in the project and being engaged as operator. And we'll see, and as Andrew mentioned before, I don't think our partners are either of them are really interested in seeing their equity positions go up. But as they work through the process with the senior lenders and see what kind of commitment for additional funding that the Koreans and the Japanese are prepared to contemplate in exchange for those deferrals, then that will then trickle down in terms of how they want to handle our position in the capital structure vis-a-vis the 12% and our CFA loans. But ultimately, everybody's objective here is stability in the capital structure. That's what the project needs ultimately in terms of certainty of its funding and consistency in the capital structure. There are a number of conversations, I think, that need to play out in sequence here, beginning with the senior lenders, But the scenario you put out in terms of us ultimately coming out of this at the other end with greater clarity on what these loans look like and what our equity, what the funding looks like, and still some form of an equity position is certainly a possibility.
Great. And then last question on the Block 10, you had you might possibly be exploring partnerships or farm down possibilities. Have you made any progress on that?
There are a couple of entities or people that we've talked to who have at least expressed preliminary interest. You know, the reality is it can't go much beyond that until we can actually show them some data. You know, the two obvious hurdles in getting anybody who's going to be willing to put up some capital for further drilling against some proportionate interest in the block will be how much oil can we show them and what kind of reservoir pressures and production rates can we show them in terms of what the economics on subsequent wells will look like. And hopefully we'll get a clear idea on that once we get this well on and run it for a few months and see what it looks like. And the second hurdle will obviously be for anybody that's going to contemplate put up new capital for investment in Cuba is, can we demonstrate to them a path to repayment on a timely basis? And that will be part and parcel of how our conversations around receivables go. And the arrangements we're trying to get in place. So beyond that, we haven't been able to, until we get some data and can show people some actual well results and technical data, it's tough to progress beyond the sort of expression of interest rate, but we'll be looking to begin that process in more earnest once we get this well on and actually hopefully be able to show the world and some potential partners some actual production.
And there are no further questions at this time. I will now turn the call back over to David Passe for closing comments.
All right. Well, thanks again for taking the time to join us. As ever, we are all around if further questions come up. There's obviously quite a lot of moving parts at the moment, but we're happy to talk about those to give you as much insight and visibility into those as we can. We will be holding our annual general meeting in the second week of June, so we'll look forward to seeing as many of you there as we can, and we'll be speaking to you again in July when we get together again to talk about second quarter release. Thanks very much. Have a good weekend.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.